ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In late May, Turkey re-elected its problematic president, Erdogan, for an unprecedented third term. Now, there were a number of factors in this historic win. His control over the media and his alliance with an ultra-nationalist party. But the fact is, his AK party is rooted in political Islam, and that played a significant part. Voters were drawn to his conservatism and religiosity. Now, for the past four decades, across the world, there have been a rise in Islamist politics. How did they get there? Through legal institutional processes or through violence, as the case with ISIS? Once in power, how do they rule? To learn more, we're joined by Dr. Joanna Cook. Joanna's assistant professor of terrorism and political violence at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University in the Netherlands. She's joined by Dr. Shiraz Maher, a lecturer in non-state actors within the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. And they've co-edited a really fascinating new book on Islamic governance called The Rule is for None but Allah. The book looks at different ways Islamists have approached governing in 15 cases across the world, from Somalia to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and more. Joanna, what exactly is Islamic governance? What is an Islamic state?
Yeah, thank you so much for having us here tonight. It's so great to join you. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks, as you kind of highlighted already, when we think of Islamic State, the first thing that jumps to mind is groups like ISIS and violent non-state actors seizing and holding and administering territory. But there's such, as you also highlighted, such a wide range of actors who pursue different versions of Islamic governance. And it's the whole point of the book was to really highlight the distinctions between these. So to give you a little bit of clarity in terms of what we're talking about, you know, there's quite a few different features that Islamists share. But again, it's really how they apply this in practice that distinguishes them. So when we talk about Islamists, we talk about individuals or groups who believe Islam is a comprehensive political ideology, and they really kind of place this at the center of their identity as the most significant or the only source. They look at the political realm and distinguish within that Muslims and other non-Muslims. And they revert to scriptural authority. So that can either be loosely interpreted or very, very dogmatically interpreted. But it's also a model of governance that is distinct and opposed to legislative systems that we would often see more in the West. And finally, you know, one that really highlights the need to satisfy the concept of tawhid or monotheism in Islam. So really part of that doctrine or the idea of applying that religious beliefs.
So it really reverts to scriptural authority at every point.
It does. But what we noted in the book and what we see in cases around the world is how that's interpreted and applied varies significantly from group to group, actor to actor. And it's really based on everything from pragmatic needs and the situation they're dealing with in that particular time and context, the actors they're interacting with, how they're negotiating with and working with local populations or facing resistance from local populations. And it's really looking at the kind of political distinctions and ways in which they interpret and apply that on the ground.
And there are many paths to power, aren't there? There's, well, you've already cited ISIS, but there's also the approach of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Absolutely. So in the book, we really highlight two types of actors. So we look at constitutional actors who try and pursue change through political means. So these are legal legal engagement in elections or electoral processes, who pursue legitimate political avenues to affect change. And they might try and impact areas such as education or social welfare, laws, judiciary, banking, for example, or foreign policy goals. But they can also politically agitate as well. They can criticize that prevailing status quo. They can hold rallies. They can protest or engage in legal ways of trying to advance their agenda. But there's also many of which I think your listeners are probably more familiar with, those that also pursue violence through insurgencies, through terrorist means to force change, so to really impose change in ways that would otherwise not be considered legal, which are often some of the most violent actors we've seen, ISIS being the most recent and well-known example.
Shiraz, remind us about the Muslim Brotherhood I mentioned and their rise in Egypt.
Well, thanks for having us. Just to echo Joanna's comments there. The Muslim Brotherhood, I suppose, is in many senses what you could say the best known or the most well-known of all the certainly the constitutional parties that are agitating for both reform, change and power across the Muslim world. And anyone who's studied political Islam or indeed radical Islam will have come across some of the group's most famous sons, such as Sayyid Qutb or Hassan al-Banna. And so this is a group that has a long-standing relationship with the entire global movement of political Islamists, whether they are indeed constitutionalists or indeed even the violent counterparts. So groups like Al-Qaeda and others have looked to some of the older teachings and doctrines of the Brotherhood from the 60s to extrapolate certain ideas, and albeit then to interpret them in different ways for the use of power. Of course, what happened in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood was that it received a truly historic moment following the Arab uprisings in 2011, where it really had, for the first time, the opportunity to contest the elections in a free and fair fashion, and were able to hold power for a relatively short period of time before falling.
Shiraz, I'd forgotten that the Muslim Brotherhood goes back almost 100 years.
Exactly. It does. It goes back, as you know, almost a century, but it also, more than just having that longevity, although that is one of the really interesting factors that the book teases out, is some of the historicism of a number of these different groups operating around the world. But it's also the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood has consistently produced thought leaders who either directly associated with the group, such as Qutb and Banna, or indeed they spawned various intellectual offshoots, such as Abdus Salam Faraj, for example, who have gone on to then inspire others in very, very radical and dangerous ways.
What happened when the Brotherhood won power almost a decade ago in Egypt?
Well, I think that was a real interesting moment for them because it highlighted a real comprehensive tension within the movement. We have a brilliant chapter by a leading scholar, Professor Martin Frampton, who's looking at this issue for us in the book. And he's noting this dichotomy between the group's different generations almost in terms of how fast they wanted to go, how radical of an agenda they wanted to implement. And of course, as they began to do that, they fell foul of Egyptian society in many parts, which led to quite a broad civil society movement against them prior to then the group being removed from power by the armed forces.
Joanna, other Islamist or Islamic groups have been, critical of the Muslim Brotherhood and their path to power, arguing, of course, that violence is the only way to achieve change.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think the most well-known and one of the most impactful cases we've seen in recent memory has, in fact, been ISIS. You know, this is a group that went and seized and administered an area of territory the size of Britain. And when
and
they
it
were
happened so
it,
quickly, Joanna. Mm-hmm.
It happened so quickly. And, you know, what was, I think, the most shocking about the case is the mobilization of actors from people from around the world that went and joined. So over 50,000 foreigners, you know, non-Iraqis, non-Syrians, from around the world went in and joined this. And they were really able to, with the territory they held and the resources within those territories, and implementing their governance, doing things like collecting taxes, selling oil, and so forth, became the most profitable and resource-rich terrorist group in history. And with that project, they were able to, for a limited period of time, again, before the global coalition and local actors really pushed them out and defeated them, but they were able to, for quite an extended period of time, really implement their vision of an Islamic State.
But you argue that this violence approach is not sustainable.
No, it's really not. And what we see in most of the cases, you see large civilian populations that do not want to deal with this violence. They do not want to be exposed to this type of violence. And often it's this really draconian kind of punishments and the violence conducted by these groups that really loses them any kind of support from local populations. But what we have seen, and what I think is really interesting when we look at different cases throughout the book, is that we've seen groups also adapt to this. And so in some cases, for example, if we looked at Al-Qaeda in Yemen, for example, they initially were conducting quite severe punishments when they held areas such as Jar and Zinjibar in 2011. But when they took over the city of Mukalla in 2015, they really rolled those really severe punishments back. And that was one of their attempts to try and get more public support. And if we look at, for example, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Syria right now, it's also a group that has really tried to distinguish itself from the kind of violence from the Al-Qaeda offshoot or from Al-Qaeda where it originally had its founding.
You make the point that long-term, if you're going to govern, you have to move beyond fighting and armed rebellion and really think about how you're going to keep, well, the water running.
Absolutely. You know, anyone will tell you as soon as the garbage stops getting picked up, as soon as the water stops running, you know, it is no longer, that government is no longer working. And you see a lot of these actors, when they do have the opportunity to govern, these great ambitions that they have also have to start dealing with the day-to-day tedium of, again, keeping the electricity on, keeping the water running, collecting taxes. And it is, again, one of these really interesting areas where you don't really think about terrorist groups in terms of collecting taxes and carrying out these kind of day-to-day governance duties. But it is something that in part of their understanding and implementation of governments, they are forced to do if they do hold or administer territory for any kind of extended period of time.
Shiraz, there is another path to power, and I find this particularly interesting. It's through social welfare. How does this play out?
So the idea of social welfare as a sort of model of attempting to both establish legitimacy and to establish soft power, in essence, over the people whom you're ruling is to essentially fill a gap or a void provided by the state. Now, that might be applicable in cases of war and conflict where the state is simply unable to provide services, such as in northwestern Syria. So Joanna mentioned Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which continues to operate on the ground and to hold territory in the northwest. We tend to forget about that in the context of Syria because with the collapse of ISIS, people have sort of thought the war is over, job done. But there is this large sort of corpus of territory up there, which is being governed in a much more intelligent way. And groups like HTS, which is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, are attempting to establish legitimacy through their provision of services. That can also happen in cases where the state does exist away from conflict, such as in Lebanon or Pakistan, where there's no immediate sort of pressing sort of kinetic action, but there are issues of just financial mispractice, corruption, and simply an inability. And so, therefore, these alternative governance models get set up, which provide you with access to healthcare, which provide you with access to education, with access to sanitation.
I remember doing a story on Hezbollah and how it set up everything from educational programs and access to food deliveries and health.
Absolutely. And that's the really critical point that we're trying to tease out in the book, is to say, if you are an impoverished person living in southern Lebanon, in rural Pakistan, in the outskirts of Yemen, or indeed any of the places that we look at. And there is a local actor which is able to provide services, which provide you with just basic human dignity, as I said, access to education, healthcare, these types of things, then that inevitably that actor generates a degree of goodwill, regardless of what your actual belief structure might be. So it's a really interesting way in which these groups are trying to cede power for themselves in a soft power way.
Joanna, we're running out of time and there's so much to cover, but we haven't raised the issue of women in Islamic governance. Please talk to that.
Yeah, of course. So Islamic governance, as conceived of by the Islamists, generally have very, very kind of clear and distinct gendered roles in their visions for society and in their visions for governance. And often these directly exclude women from roles of leadership. But what we do see is that, you know, three particular groups of women are often impacted. So those that are forced to live under those groups, women who actually go and join these groups or make an effort to find membership or a role within them, and then women who are also targeted by these groups. So if we take the case of ISIS, for example, you know, as a state-building project, they needed women to legitimize their vision of a society. They saw women from around the world coming to join them, and that helped legitimize their vision for governance, for their state. But we also saw them impose governance on local women in Iraq and Syria who were forced to comply with the rules that were being imposed on them. And we also saw groups such as Yazidis who were absolutely targeted by the group and suffered severely under ISIS because of how the governance and the ideology viewed Yazidis. So they were viewed as heretics. And there was an idea of how women could be treated if they fell under this category. So it's such an important aspect, and I look a lot at the role of women, but you have to think about religious minorities as well. So whether it's the Christian Coptics, for example, in Egypt or other minority groups around the regions, also thinking about how these governance projects not only conceive of the roles for women, but other religious minorities or other minority groups in those regions as well.
Of course, we've been watching with fascinated horror how the role of women in Afghanistan is, you know, they're becoming ever more repressed.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Taliban had initially suggested that they would let women continue in education. So there was, once upon a time, there was hope that their vision for how education would be applied to women would evolve. And we can see that they've rolled it back to the 1990s here. So in their current vision, women are heavily restricted from the public space, heavily restricted from education, and they comprise one of the most extreme visions and interpretations of Islamic governance in the world today.
Thank you both very much. I've been talking to Dr. Joanna Cook, Assistant Professor of Terrorism and Political Violence at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs at the Leiden University in the Netherlands. And she was joined by Dr. Shiraz Meyer, a lecturer in non-state actors with the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. And let me remind you, the pair have co-edited a fascinating new book on Islamic governance published by Hearst.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.